Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this latest episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston, and coming up, we will be talking about how a physicist has turned a passion for crystals and gemstones into a career in quantum physics and the production of diamonds for high-tech applications. We will meet a Russian scientist who talks about how his career was inspired by the U.S. Apollo moon missions. And we'll also hear what our readers have said about how research labs can reduce their impact on the environment. And we have some new features in this episode. We'll be hearing about audience feedback about how our readers are planning to reduce their carbon footprint. And we'll also hear about the game of quantum tic-tac-toe, which has been invented by a physicist in California. But first up, I'm joined by Physics World's Susan Curtis to talk about new research that puts to rest the idea that current trends in global warming are on par with climate fluctuations that have occurred in the past two millennia. This week, an international team that includes Nathan Steiger of Columbia University in the U.S. and Raphael Neukomm of the University of Bern in Switzerland have looked at temperature data stretching back 2,000 years, and they've found that prior to the Industrial Revolution, there were no climate change trends that affected the entire planet at the same time.
So that sounds quite significant, Hamish, and it also goes against conventional wisdom. After all, we know about periods like the medieval warm period, when temperatures were higher than the long-term average.
Yes, I think this will come as a surprise to many researchers, particularly climate historians, who talk about climate epochs, such as the Roman warm period, the Dark Ages cold period, and of course the Little Ice Age. And some climate experts had thought that these were global phenomena. Instead, this study has shown that these events were strictly regional effects, and also that they're consistent with climate variability. It is only well into the Industrial Revolution that the researchers found true global warming effects.
So does this blow a hole in the whole idea that the current global warming that we're seeing is another example of natural climate variability?
Yeah, I think so. Although the researchers say that they haven't looked specifically at the causes of the current warming trend, they say that their recent work can rule out natural variability. So I suppose if you were maybe hoping that things would start getting cooler soon, and this was all just a natural variation in climate, you might be out of luck. You can read more about this on the Physics World website in an article called "Global Scale of Earth's Recent Warming is Unique Within the Past 2,000 Years," and that's by a regular contributor, Marek Stevens. So Susan, what are some other popular news stories this week?
This week I've picked out a couple that caught my eye. So the most popular of all this week is an article that's called "Microbes on the Moon." And this is by a physicist called Michael Hill King. And the article first appeared in Physics World magazine. Now, Michael was intrigued by the final scene of the 2018 film called First Man, which shows the returning astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin at the end when they landed back on the Earth in quarantine. Now, Michael and his wife, and his wife happens to be a microbiologist, were wondering why the astronauts needed to be quarantined, what contaminants they might have brought back from the moon. And so they decided to investigate a bit further. And you can find out what they found out in the article, "Microbes on the Moon." Another article that was very popular this week is a new research report of the first ever observation of a ferromagnetic liquid by scientists in the US and China. Now, the researchers made the permanent magnets from small droplets of liquid, and they showed that they could change the shapes of the magnetized droplets. And they think that this could lead to some really interesting practical applications, such as actuators for soft robots. And you can find out more about that research in the article, First Ever Ferromagnetic Liquid Surprises Researchers.
That was an interesting story because it was a classic discovery. They discovered it by accident. They were working on some other aspect of materials and suddenly decided to measure the magnetic properties of these of this liquid after they'd taken the magnetic field away and were shocked to discover that it was still magnetic. So, you know, there's a certain amount of serendipity involved in some of these fantastic discoveries. And yeah, it's an interesting story.
Yeah, that one has certainly sort of intrigued our readers this week and is definitely one of the most popular stories of the week.
Now I'm joined by Physics World's James Dacey. Hi, James.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, you've spoken recently to a Russian planetary scientist about the South Pole of the Moon. Who did you speak to and why is he interested in lunar poles?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a guy called Igor Mitrofanov. And so he's at the Russian Academy of Sciences. And he was speaking a couple of months ago, actually, at the General Assembly of the European Geosciences Union in Vienna. And there was a special session there on space exploration. And so what he was doing, he gave a quick sort of overview of the original Soviet program, the series of missions that went to the moon. I mean, obviously, we know they didn't send a man to the moon or a woman, but they did send between 1959 and 1976. They had a series of robotic missions which involved orbiters and a couple of landers as well. So he spoke about that, and then the Russians are basically planning to revive that program with Luna 25, which is scheduled for launch in 2021. So yeah, like you said, they're going to go to this polar region, the South Pole region of the Moon.
And what's so special about the South Pole of the Moon?
So the way Igor explained it is that because the Moon doesn't have an atmosphere like the Earth, and it doesn't have plate tectonics, it's got a preserved record of the early solar system. And so as we understand it, early on in the history of the solar system, the Earth and the Moon were bombarded by comets. And there is a theory actually as to how life might have emerged on Earth, and it could have been triggered or seeded by some material from the interstellar medium which was brought to Earth in these comets. So if that was on the Earth, yeah, that record would have been lost, you know, millions, billions of years ago. But in this south polar region of the Moon, you've got these frozen ices with volatiles, which might contain what he described as kind of precursors to life. So he's not going to find, you know, some little green man or even microbes, but it's just perhaps some of the clues or the materials which could have then led to the process that triggered life.
Wow, well, that's interesting. So looking for clues about how life began on Earth by looking at the Moon.
That's right, yeah.
Well, here's that clip with James talking to Igor.
Because I think you described it this morning as pre-organic potentially. Mm-hmm. So by that, what do you mean? So obviously you're not talking about, you know, finding life itself, but it's something that could be a clue to the origins of life.
Of course, because it's not quite clear why such a complex molecules mm-hmm. are appearing. Mm. And there are some hypotheses that probably interstellar media is the most natural or appropriate place in the universe where such a complex molecules may be combined. Mm-hmm. And we know from astronomy, this is a lot of data from astronomical observations, from spectroscopy, that there are very complex molecules in the interplanetary space. And if we are comparing this with a primitive ocean on the Earth, it may be not such a favorable conditions, elements which are necessary for such creation of molecules. So it may be possible that delivery of such molecules to the ocean of the Earth maybe not just start the origin of life, but be favorable mm-hmm. for some more complex reactions in chemistry, which will provide more and more complex molecules.
It's like a precursor to something, or triggering process.
Yeah. Or catalysis or mm-hmm. something like that. So, of course, people do not know, but mm-hmm. what is important is that people do not know mm-hmm. what was the ignition of mm-hmm. life. We may believe to Darwin's theory of evolution, it's mm-hmm. okay, but we need to understand something, how it was started, mm-hmm. what was the first event wow. in the early Earth ocean, which then was evolved to the current biosphere.
I've read a couple of places that Russia is also interested in the long run of going, mm-hmm. you know, landing somebody on the moon. So, mm-hmm. I mean, is there a kind of concrete timeline for that or not at this stage? It's too early.
The timeline is now discussed as a next decade. Mm. But my feeling is that it most probably at the end of the next decade. So it is not 2023 or 2024. I'm more believing that it will be something like 2028, 2029. Mm. And in this case, the first point, which we all understand very well, that the major issue is money. You may know that robotic mission is orders of magnitude cheaper than pilot missions. Mm. So for robotic missions, it's not a large deal to have enough money for the project, for full project. But for the men, it is necessary to have much more heavier systems, which immediately means that you have much more heavier rocket. You have to decrease your risk much, much more than in case of robotic. Even for robotic, we are very careful about low risk, but for men, it is even more important. So I think that money is the first issue. Second issue, again, is to develop necessary complex, if you wish, space complex to go, starting from the heavy rocket, then the spacecraft to go to the orbit around Moon. And such rocket is now under development in Russia. Similar rocket is under development in US. And Americans develop Orion for such missions. We are developing Federation spacecraft for such missions. But it is not enough. It is also necessary to build the lander.
The original space race, it was all about America versus the USSR. Maybe more realistically in the future, it would be more about working together, the different agencies to build a mission that, and developing the different parts. Or do you think that's just not the way it works because of the politics? And
I am absolutely sure that it is the most favorable approach, and I think that ISS is actually a very good example of such cooperation. Mm. Mm. We already know many cases when humans, which are now flying permanently, now we have humans permanently in space. It is very important stage of our civilization that from this time forever, we will have permanent presence of humans in the space. And it is very important that the humans have this International Space Station. And for example, if one module has some particular technical problem, people may survive in another module. And you know that it is also quite important that different nations may use a little bit different technologies. So in this case, the failure of one type of technology give you opportunity to recover, because this is like necessity of different transportation system, for example, for the space station. And definitely we need such opportunity for the lunar flights, because again, we need to decrease the risk as much as possible. Public will only support our space efforts if we will not risk with people when we send them so far. So I am sure that international cooperation is the most favorable pathway to the future moon exploration. But on the other hand, another part of this story is a mutual dependence. When you are in the process of cooperation, you depend. One side depend on another side. Mm. So sometime this is a favorable because you share the cost and you again decrease the risk. On the other hand, this dependence provide you some difficulties if for some reason one side decide not to continue.
Okay, yeah, suddenly the whole plan is gone.
Yeah. So for example, if you bought some car from Japan, for example, and this is a nice car, you use it very well, but if you need to repair, you need to have some parts. Mm. And if you may easily get these parts from Japan, it's okay. But if for some reason Japan will, I am not speaking about some particular case, but some another provider, I would say, will stop the provision of these parts, you may use, you may not use your car. Mm. So this is an issue which now is becoming more and more sensitive in sense of cooperation.
So you need long-term commitments.
Commitments and high level of mutual responsibility for keeping established relations. And in this case, this dependence will not be so critical. Mm-hmm. I think that another very important product, if you wish, of our space efforts is the influence to the young generation. Mm. Because I spoke oftenly with people in our country, I also spoke oftenly with people of my age in the United States and in the Europe, and many of us belong to so-called Gagarin generation or Apollo generation. Mm. And we remember enthusiasm which was in the young community to go to science, to develop technology, to become a creator of new space system, even to become astronauts or cosmonauts. Mm. And I think it is very practical result, very important result for our space efforts, because people not only want to buy products and to consume them, they want to have some dream, they want to have some motivation. And I think the space program give them very strong motivations for coming to science. And it is not absolutely necessary that this girl or boy will become a space industry person. It may become some inventor or some another things, but he came to space, he came to high technology college or to this university, he obtained good education, he is now interested to create something new, and attraction for such efforts was based on the space.
That's right. It's hard to quantify that, isn't it? When you're looking at the cost of a mission, it's difficult to put a value on the importance of that. It's so important, but it sometimes doesn't get mentioned.
One my good colleague from NASA told one day the phrase, I share this phrase very much, that all spent money stay on the Earth. They do not go to space. They do not go to Mars or to the Earth. This money support people which create that, and creating that, they are also creating a very large another branches of space, of science and technology. So we do not spend money for the black hole, to the black hole. We spend money here, and money will give us very good intellectual and scientific profit.
Next up is Tushna Commissariat, who is our careers expert. And Tushna is with me to talk about an article in the magazine and on the website called Diamonds Are a Physicist's Best Friend. Hi, Tushna.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, the article is an interview with someone called Pascal Gallo, and he's the co-founder and chief executive of a Swiss startup company called Lake Diamond. So what exactly does this company do?
Well, Hamish, basically what they do is that they manufacture artificial diamonds. And before you start wondering why exactly they're featured in Physics World, these are the kind of diamonds that are very regularly used in a lot of physics experiments, but actually across the sciences. You know, diamonds are a very popular tool. And these are what a scientist would describe as ultra-pure diamonds. So they have none of those flaws in them that actually make the kind of diamonds that people like to wear look quite beautiful.
Because the flaws often change the colour, don't they?
Indeed, exactly. Yeah. So these are ultra-pure diamonds that are used in, they're used for really so many things, very often in lasers and certain high-energy lasers and things like that, but also like battery charging, medical imaging, different tiny quantum sensors and things like that. So just a whole array of applications, really.
That's right, yeah. I mean, that's something that we write about a lot on Physics World, the nitrogen vacancy center in
the
a diamond,
NDs, yeah.
Which is a sort of an amazing thing. It can be used to sense magnetic fields. It can be used as a qubit. You know, it's really amazing what you can do with a tiny defect in a diamond. Now Gallo was a physicist. How did he go from being a physicist to founding a company?
He has quite an interesting story, I must say. So one of the things that we've started doing in the past year or so is we have a section almost in the careers section called Startup Stories. And it's because there's so many people, so many physicists today setting up their own companies because they realize the potential of what they're developing in the lab. And Gallo has a really interesting story. So, I mean, funnily enough, his grandfather was a mine prospector in Africa way back in the day, and he actually discovered these two minerals. I think they're marakite and the other one's just a nightmare to say, godefroyite, something like that. So he discovered these two minerals. And so, you know, Gallo growing up with him, he would like, you know, they had lots of mineral collection in the house and that. He'd love looking at them. And apparently he used to even nick some of these and sort of swap them at school with his mates, you know. So he clearly grew up around sort of gemstones and things like that. And he really enjoyed it. And then, of course, funnily enough, like so many scientists we asked today, where did your interest in physics come from? And it's the good old Red Hawking's Brief History of Time, and sort of also had a very strong mathematical ability when he was younger. So, you know, he his first foray into physics was that his master's degree. He had a master's degree in engineering physics. And this is from the National Institute of Applied Sciences in France, in Toulouse. And interestingly enough, his degree, though, was in engineering physics and in management, because this particular school offered a branch of the study that they offered was you could do physics, but you'd also learn about, you know, he said, law and finance and economy. So clearly he was already on the path towards setting up a company. You know, he was learning all these skills. And then he went on to do his PhD, and that was on quantum physics and crystal growth. Interestingly enough, his PhD research, he worked with the 2007 Nobel Prize winner, Albert Fert, who, as I'm sure you know, Hamish,
I've met Albert Fert.
Have you?
I have, yes. I interviewed him. It was years ago. And there's a video, rather embarrassing video of me. Albert looks great. Interviewing him. I think it was at the Royal Society.
Oh, yes,
in London.
I remember that one.
So check out the Physics World website for that interview.
So yeah, Albert and his the other person to win with him that year was Peter Grunberg, and they won for the discovery of giant magnetoresistance, you know, spintronics. And again, all of that, as you can see, is in this family of, you know, using these little magnetic sensors and things like that. So Gallo was working with him, and then while he was working there, he also, you know, he spent a year and a half working at the Laboratory for Analysis and Architecture of Systems, and while he was there, he started working with Eli Capon, who is now an important part of Lake Diamond, actually. And what they did there was that they developed this amazing laser, this diamond-based laser that apparently smashed every world record for laser energy transmission. And what basically what they do is that they put tiny, tiny diamonds in the cavities of the lasers. And that just, and you know, so Gallo explains in the article that basically diamond is an amazing conductor of heat too.
Yeah, that's something that's really surprising. I always find it surprising that a diamond is a really good conductor of heat. But another amazing property.
Another amazing, exactly, yeah. And so apparently, basically what it allows you to do is it allows you to heat up and thereby power up your laser more and more, because the diamond just, you know, sort of conducts and absorbs all that heat without blowing up your laser. So that was something that they built together with Eli Kapon. And so they had this breakthrough, and Gallo thought, this is great. I want to set up a company. I really want to make these lasers. But there was a snag in that they really couldn't find any really good source of these ultra pure diamonds, and that they would need a vast number of these, obviously, not just one or two they could make in the lab. And so he realized that maybe that there was the opportunity. Maybe they could make these really pure synthetic diamonds. And so that's where his idea came. So this was like early 2011, but they didn't actually set up Lake Diamond until 2015. So the next couple of years, especially between 2012 and 2014, Gallo worked at a number of other companies. So this is where I think he really probably learned a lot. He saw how these scientific businesses were run, where you took your great idea in the lab, but then spin it out to something that works in the real world. So he worked at Beam Express, which was a Swiss startup company that made ultrafast lasers for telecoms. And then he worked at another company called Novagan. He was their chief business development officer, actually. And then it was after that, together with Kapon in 2015, they finally set up Lake Diamond. And it's done. It's done really well, the whole business. So yeah, he's the CTO, CEO now. And so obviously, you know, he kind of jokes and he says that there was a time when he would just, you know, go and work in the lab and that would be it. And now he wears many different hats, juggles many different roles. You know, he said this really interesting thing that he said, now I have to do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and the rhythm changes all the time. And I think that was something quite interesting that I think many research scientists are used to, a very steady rhythm.
That's right, yeah. I think, yeah, I suppose if you like that, you know, sort of general rhythm of life, then maybe business isn't for you.
Indeed.
But yeah, that is a fascinating career. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you didn't meet Gallo, did you?
So I didn't.
That article was written by...
So it was written by one of our very good freelancers. She's Giuliana Fotopoulos. So she's a sort of established science writer based between Bristol and Greece, actually. And she was attending the Hello Tomorrow Summit, which, you know, is this one of these sort of scientific, all aspects of science. It was a conference held in March this year. And she actually identified Gallo as someone quite interesting and reached out to me and asked if we'd like an interview with him. And I thought he was a fascinating person to interview for our career section. So yeah, it was Giuliana who spoke to him.
And you mentioned that that Gallo did an engineering physics degree. If you want to know more about engineering physics, in an upcoming podcast, I have an interview with Ray LaPierre, who's the head of the engineering physics department at McMaster University in Canada. And he explains exactly what engineering physics is. And he does mention the options in terms of business as well as physics. So if you are interested in physics and engineering, stay tuned for more about engineering physics. Is physics an environmentally friendly endeavor? We asked that question in June when we published an article by Ben Skuse called Leading by Example, Going Green in the Lab. As well as highlighting the need to keep fume hood windows closed, Skuse points out the huge amounts of energy used by large facilities like the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Not surprisingly, we've had some interesting feedback from readers about this timely issue. And here to discuss some of those letters to the editor is the editor, Mateen Durrani. So what have we been hearing from our readers, Mateen, about energy use in the lab?
Hi, Hamish. Well, we had a couple of really interesting letters that came in. I think I mentioned one on a previous podcast. People who were listening might remember that. So one was from Chris Llewellyn Smith.
And that's a familiar name.
Yeah.
Big name in physics.
He was a one-time director general of CERN, the particle physics lab. And for about a decade, he was president of the Council of SESAME, which is a synchrotron X-ray source that's being built in the Middle East to bring scientists from across the region together.
Is that in Jordan? Is that
in Jordan, yeah. In fact, I think one of our colleagues, Michael Banks, has been there, and we've got an invitation to go there later in the year. So,
oh, hopefully, maybe when it's not so hot.
Yeah, let's see. So, yeah, it's pretty hot there. But what he wrote in his letter, he said that having read Ben Skuse' article, he wanted to mention that SESAME has its own solar power plant built with funds from the EU. And so that was a really great example of labs taking the initiative to improve their green credentials. So that was an interesting letter. And then also we got another one from Peter Main, who's head of physics at King's College in London. And he also noticed that what Ben Skuse had said about the amount of energy that's used at CERN. And he noticed that Ben had said that CERN uses 1.3 terawatt hours of electricity a year, which apparently converts to 400 tons of CO2. And that sounds a lot, but Peter Main did a kind of back of the envelope calculation, looking at the fact that CERN has, I think, 11,000 scientists and visitors who come to the lab or are based there. And of course, they've all got to make trips back home by plane. So he calculated from his back of the envelope calculation that those scientists emit 100,000 tons of CO2 a year. So that's way in excess of the 400 tons a year from the experiments. So basically his point, he's not picking on particle physicists, but he's basically making the point that the travel we do to conferences and scientific facilities around the world emits a stack of CO2. And that then tied in, Hamish, we had that other story on Physics World, didn't we, about
Whether it's a good idea to travel, whether your career benefits from going to lots of conferences. And
yeah,
the idea was, well, maybe not.
Yeah, someone, I think it was at university in Canada, they looked at data from scientists who traveled at that university to various conferences, and they'd worked out how their citation record had changed, how many times their papers had been cited. And I think we discussed it at length in a previous podcast, but the bottom line, I think, was that if you went on one trip a year, it certainly helped your citation record. But the more you went on after that, it didn't seem to make much of a difference.
So you go to the one big conference in your field. That's important.
Go to the one big one and meet all the people, but there's no point going to, or less point going to, many more different conferences.
Right. And so you've decided to ask our readers or listeners what they think about this and whether they would be willing to forego trips to conferences?
Yeah, that's right, Hamish. So we were talking about trying to get a bit more interactivity into the podcast. So each week we'll have a Twitter poll that we'll tell listeners the results of. So the first one we did was, I put it out a couple of days ago. So the question was, you know, with the scientific conference season getting underway, would you cut the number of flights that you take to help make the world a greener place?
And I think you've got some. Do you have some preliminary results?
Yeah, well, I don't. I can't remember how you voted, Hamish, but there were four choices. So 57% of people said yes, they would. The Earth comes first. They reduce the number of flights to help make the world a greener place. 6% said yeah, they would cut the number of flights, but only if others were not doing so either. I think that's the sitting on the fence option. 18% said they'd never thought about this before. And 19% said, no way, Hawaii, here we come. They would just not abandon those flights. If there's a juicy conference, they're going to go on it.
There is a big conference coming up in Hawaii, isn't there?
Yeah, but as long as it's the one you go to this year, Hamish,
Okay. Don't go to
any others.
I'm not sure about Hawaii. I mean, we're sitting here in Bristol when the temperature is supposed to be in the 30s today. So I'd like to go somewhere really cool. Rather than somewhere really hot at the moment. But yeah, I'm sure in December, Hawaii would be very tempting. But it's a long way, isn't it?
How did you vote in the poll, Hamish?
Oh, I have to say, I haven't voted yet.
If the push came to shove, what would you do? If someone had those dangling those conference tickets to Hawaii, would you say, no, I'm not going? Or would you put principles first?
Well, you know, I think I might follow the advice of my, you know, fellow Canadian, the person who did that research. Typically, I go to one big conference every year. You know, normally that conference is in the United States, and I do get a lot out of it. So I think I'd probably stick with that principle, and then maybe, you know, go to some smaller local conferences, possibly by train, you know, in the UK. So yeah, I can definitely see the appeal of doing the one conference and not going to lots of conferences.
Yeah, or you could Skype in. Does Skype still exist?
Well, I think other platforms are available. Yeah, I mean, I use something called Zencastr to interview people far away, and that seems to work very well. So yeah, there are platforms available for that, definitely.
Right. So away from air travel, Hamish, you're going to tell us something now about I can't say this, Hamish. Tic-tac-toe. Look, it's noughts and crosses. It's quantum tic-tac-toe. But what is this? I'd call it noughts and crosses. What's this all about?
Yeah, this is something that I wrote about in my latest red folder roundup of quirky physics stories, and that's something that we publish once a week on Friday. I came across a blog written by a Dutch physicist, and apologies to any Dutch speakers listening. His name is Evert van Nieuwenberg. And he's at Caltech, and he's proposed a new game called Quantum Tic-Tac-Toe, or Quantum Noughts and Crosses, for Matine. The idea, as far as I can tell, is that players can put down a cross, for example, on a 3x3 grid in a quantum superposition of two locations on that grid. And this means that the other player can put a knot on a location that may already contain a cross. And this location will be in a superposition of a knot and a cross.
That sounds complicated.
yeah, it is very complicated as far as I can tell. He then goes on to explain how the effects of phase and interference, you know, all that sort of quantum wave function stuff, affects the outcome of the game. And if you want to learn more, he's made an app that provides a simple tutorial of this quantum tic-tac-toe. But let's get back to the name. It's interesting, in his blog, he makes the claim, I think, that the name tic-tac-toe is actually Dutch in origin.
So there was me thinking it was some abomination and Americanism, and it's actually Dutch.
Well, that's what he says, and he says the name comes from a pastime. I can vaguely remember this time in Canada when you had things delivered to your door. And I think in Holland, they had, let's say, bread and cheese and milk delivered to the door every day. And every evening, they would fill out a little check list that they would leave out for the delivery person. And that checklist was called a tic-tac-toe for some reason in Dutch. And so the checklist was a little grid where you'd put a knot or a cross, depending on whether you wanted cheese or bread.
So what, it was a 3x3 grid?
But possibly, yeah, I don't know. You'll have to...
You played a game with the delivery person, though. What was the...
Well, I think the grid, you know, the grid was similar to the knots and crosses grid.
Right.
And so that's how it became tic-tac-toe. Apparently, that's what Evert claims in his in his blog. So you have to read that.
This quantum version, they're going to have to give it a different name, aren't they? Is it going to have a name, noughts and ones and crosses and what will they call it?
Oh, well, he calls it quantum tic-tac-toe, and that's spelt T-I-Q-T-A-Q-T-O-E.
Oh, I see.
So presumably
right.
The Qs are in
Q's
there.
The quantum that, element.
Yeah,
right.
The quantum
okay.
element. Now, I'm sure I did no justice in explaining the game. So you can read more in my column, which is titled Quantum Tic-Tac-Toe, Stanley Kubrick and Moon Landing Fakes, and Why Become a Particle Theorist. That's quite the headline. And you'll find that in the blog section of the Physics World website. And there's a link there to Evert's description of quantum tic-tac-toe. I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Tushna, Susan, Mateen, and James for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. And don't forget, if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. We're also now available on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week. Bye.
Physics World.